From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we're continuing to watch the response around the globe after Britain's vote to leave the EU. In a moment, we'll hear from economist and former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers.
But first to Washington. On this, the last day of this year's Supreme Court session, three decisions from the eight-person court. One, the first major abortion case in 9 years, and in its ruling, the court upheld abortion rights. In a 5-3 decision, the court reversed a lower court ruling and overturned a Texas abortion law. The court also upheld restrictions that prevent those convicted of misdemeanor counts of domestic violence from owning a gun. And in a unanimous ruling, the court vacated or threw out corruption charges against former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell. Dahlia Lithwick covers the Supreme Court for Slate. She joins us now from Washington. And Dahlia, start with the abortion case. It was argued back in March. We saw reporting suggesting it was just recently wrapped up. Tell us first what the Texas law required.
Sure. This was the famous HB2, the big omnibus Texas legislation that, as you may remember, in 2013 over Wendy Davis's filibuster went into effect. The two provisions of the law that were at issue today before the court were a provision that required doctors to have admitting privileges at local hospitals if they were going to perform abortions, and also that would retrofit any abortion clinic as an ambulatory surgical center. This becomes very, very cost prohibitive and would have had the effect, the two provisions, had they gone into effect, would have really taken Texas from having 40 clinics down to 10.
Yeah, not because it just the clinics said that they just could not abide by the requirements. But, you know, are you surprised at the decision? Most of the conversation this term has been about the absence of the late Justice Scalia, but a 5-3 vote suggests he wouldn't have made a difference.
That's exactly right, Robin. I think all eyes were on Justice Anthony Kennedy. He's been a tricky one on the abortion front because, of course, he was part of the majority of the court in 1992, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, that really gave force to Roe v. Wade and set up this undue burden test that we looked at today. But then he's also been in a later case that had to do with partial birth abortion in 2007, went the other way and voted with the conservatives to uphold the partial birth abortion ban. And so I think it's fair to say all eyes were on Anthony Kennedy back when this was argued. All eyes were on Kennedy today. And you're quite right. It would have been 5-4 with Justice Scalia.
Well, let's turn to the case about gun rights. This was about restricting people with domestic violence charges. Two men from Maine had these charges of domestic abuse. They were barred from owning a gun. What did the court say about their argument?
Well, the question was whether these misdemeanor domestic violence convictions can include what's known, and this is just the intention standard of the defendant, whether reckless conduct as opposed to knowing or intentional conduct can also sweep away your gun rights. In other words, it expanded the idea that it's sufficient to just act recklessly in a domestic violence situation to have your gun rights taken away.
What's the difference? What's the difference between reckless? What's the difference?
Robin, Elena Kagan explained it so eloquently from the bench this morning as though we were all seven. But it's basically the difference between wanting to hurt somebody and sort of knowing that the plate you threw – this is the example she gave – the plate you threw in a fight might crack and hit somebody on the head. So it's sort of you should have known that this was going to hurt someone that's reckless as opposed to intending to hurt somebody.
Okay. So these men were saying, hey, it was more reckless. I didn't realize what I did was going to hurt somebody. I should get a gun.
Well, more or less. And, you know, the interesting thing was Justice Clarence Thomas and Justice Sonia Sotomayor are the two dissenters. They could not agree on less things, but on this case, they both agreed that recklessness is not sufficient to lose your gun right.
Huh. But they did lose this decision, the rest of the justice voting that it is. Finally, former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell, who was convicted on corruption charges, the court unanimously vacated and remanded the conviction. Now, he was supposed to serve prison time. He won't. But what else does this mean, this decision?
Well, this was important because it was unanimous. We had eight justices agree to vacate this conviction. John Roberts, writing the for the court was at pains to say, look, his conduct was tawdry. It was distasteful. He was at pains to say, you know, he was taking Ferraris and Rolexes and fancy ball gowns. And this is, let's all stipulate, this is yucky. The question is, under the federal corruption statute, whether this is sufficient to be a, quote, official act. And the Chief Justice and the rest of the court said, you know, just agreeing, as McDonald did, to have some meetings, to give some speeches, to, like, get people together, that does not constitute an official act under the corruption statute. You have to have a narrower definition of the quid and the pro and the quo. And the court said today, those federal statutes have to be read narrowly.
So he should not be feeling today his name has been cleared. Yucky is, you know, one word that you use. But it is not, it was not deserving of the prison sentence in their decision. Dahlia Lithwick of Slate, on the final three rulings from the Supreme Court. Dahlia, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we are also following the markets today, down again following the UK's vote to leave the European Union. And joining us now is Larry Summers, former Treasury Secretary and President Emeritus of Harvard University. Welcome back.
Glad to be with you, Jeremy.
Well, what are your concerns at this point as you watch the global market reaction to what happened in the UK?
Look, I think we're in a difficult situation that is in one important respect unprecedented. And that is that interest rates are so low in the industrial world that if there is an adverse shock, and certainly there's some evidence of an adverse shock so far, central banks will not be able to respond in the usual way with policy that accommodates. To prevent recessions and to contain recessions, the U.S. Fed normally reduces interest rates by 400 basis points. We don't have anything like that kind of room right now, and even if you make allowance for quantitative easing, negative rates, forward guidance, various tools, there's nothing like the equivalent of 400 basis points of room. So I think this adverse shock comes at a time when the global economy is brittle. I think also, beyond its significance for the economy of the United Kingdom, which I think is likely to be fairly large, they'll more likely than not, I would say, have at least a mild recession. There's a major psychological impact from the fact that people are going to become very uncertain about where Europe is going. They're going to become more uncertain about what's been a 70-year project since the Second World War of increasing global integration. And in that context, I think we have got to be concerned that that's going to discourage business investment, that that's going to discourage hiring, that in a world that's so uncertain, you know, there's a U.S. election in this fall, there's a German and French election next fall, nobody knows quite what's going to happen in terms of the politics of Britain. I think the tendency is going to be to freeze up and slow down on investment and hiring plans, and that then has the prospect of becoming a bit of a self-fulfilling negative prophecy.
And by the way, when you use the term 400 basis points, what you're talking about is 4%.
Four percentage points on interest rates, yes, Jim.
And one thing that we do know is that the value of the pound is dropping in comparison to all the currencies, but the dollar seems to be getting stronger in the face of this. Is that good or bad for the United States?
The dollar usually gets strong when bad things happen in the world, because for all our problems, we are still a safe haven. And so when people are nervous, that's where people bring their money back to the United States. And that's why the dollar has risen, and that's why long-term interest rates have fallen very substantially in the United States, because people are buying bonds. It's a mixed blessing. On the one hand, it means that we'll be able to buy imported goods at a lower price, and it's better to be living in a country that capital is trying to get into than a country that capital is trying to get out of. On the other hand, it is going to make it harder for U.S. exporters to compete. It's going to make it easier for foreign countries to sell their products here. And it's going to tend to shift demand from the United States to the rest of the world. So I would say it's a rather mixed development. I would say of more concern is what's happened to the stock market of more concern is a sense that we are dependent on the global economy, and this is going to bring strains quite generally to the global economy.
And if you take those strains and add them to what you said earlier about the possibility that the UK could face recession, what do you think are the chances that we will have a recession here in the United States because of what just happened?
Well, I think that when you have a recovery that's been going for a substantial interval and is pretty slow, running at about 2%, before anything, I think the chances were 20 or 25% each year that the economy would go into recession. Now, with this adverse development, I think it's probably 25 or 30%.
So just a little bit more.
That will go into recession in the next year, and that's why I'm quite concerned.
That's Larry Summers, President Emeritus of Harvard University and the former Treasury Secretary. Thank you so much once again for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Last week, Pakistanis mourned the murder of Amjad Sabri, who performed devotional music and had been accused by other Muslims of blasphemy against the Prophet. Authorities say it was a targeted killing, an act of terrorism. Some say it was the work of Deobandi militants. Now, the BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones has been exploring the Deobandi School of Islam, which started in the Indian town of Deoband 150 years ago and has inspired both a peaceful global missionary movement and violence in groups like the Taliban. Owen joins us now. And you remind us it's important to understand there are different Muslim sects. So how do the Deobandis intersect with Wahhabis or Salafis?
Well, it's a fascinating subject, really, because over the years since 9/11, there has been a lot of comment about Salafis and Wahhabis and people becoming more aware of these different sects of Islam and what they might mean in terms of the radicalization of some Muslims. So, you know, in general terms, I think it's fair to say that most of the attention has been on Wahhabis and Saudi Arabia. And whenever there are attacks, including 9/11 for obvious reasons, and that's why it all happened this way, because 9/11 was largely done by Saudis who were Wahhabis, people have focused on that. In fact, certainly in the UK, there are very, very few Wahhabis and many, many more Deobandis. They have not dissimilar views on religion, very conservative, very austere. And in the UK, there is undoubtedly a link between those who are being convicted of terror offences and Deobandism. So it's tended to slip under the radar, despite being a mass world movement.
So you decided to go to its source and to see how it had branched out around the world. But you'd already, in your reporting, you'd already come across it. You tell a story of hearing about a town in northern Pakistan, Deobandi, and they decided to burn all their television sets.
Well, that was years and years ago, yes. Yeah. And I was just up in Islamabad and read a newspaper article saying they'd had this bonfire of TVs. So this must have been, I don't know, 1999, something like that. So I went up there and they had burnt their TVs. You know, this was the Deobandis, basically. Yeah. And you know, these are the people who have formed the Taliban and the Afghan Taliban, Pakistan Taliban. And if you look at all the sectarian groups on the Sunni side in Pakistan, so all these groups that are killing Shias, they're all Deobandi. And yet, you know, we never really hear the term even Deobandi. You know, I asked the guy who runs the Deobandi, the main headquarters of it all, as it were, in Deoband, north of Delhi, how many institutions he had around the world. Mm. And he said, oh, I don't know, we don't really count, but something like 100,000.
100,000, I know. Well, so you're there at Dera Alum in India. This is the world headquarters of Deobandism. And you're walking through and you say, wow, this is one of the most relaxed madrasas schools I've been to in my life. Kids are playing volleyball, thousands of them. You know, it's just places just teeming with life. But also, you know, you're talking to people who are practicing an austere puritanical faith. What do you find?
Well, I mean, it is quite striking because I've been to quite a few Deobandi madrasas and seminaries in Pakistan. And, you know, I mean, they're always tricky. I mean, you know, difficult to get in. And then people are very hostile, frankly. And the students all think that you're, you know, an American and that, you know, they're very upset to see you there. And these are the places that, you know, produce, frankly, lots of violent jihadists who go on to fight in Afghanistan and Pakistan. They've got close links with militants. Yeah, I was quite struck in India that it wasn't really like that. The Indian government, it turns out, has basically squashed militancy out of Deoband. So it is pretty much what it's meant to be, which is a religious seminary imparting this version of Islam to thousands of students who turn up every year.
And here's a clip of you speaking with some of the students. This is a 25-year-old. He's been studying at this madrasa since he was 10. He's speaking through an interpreter.
I came here to learn. We don't study here in order to get jobs or good employment. Our purpose is to serve the religion and to propagate what we learn.
So it seems, simple enough. But you also speak to other people here at the madrasas, people who have been your guides. And again, this is in India. And at one point, I was really struck how they make a reasoned argument for how, if in fact they are trying to push their faith, you know, as far as they're trying to push it, that's what Christians did. The Christians came and almost destroyed their faith in India. That's very much present in their minds.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the point is that the Deobandis began back in the 1870s in the wake of what the British called the Indian Mutiny, or what the Indians would call their first war of independence. And this retreat to Deoband, where they formed this institution that could preserve true Islam, has been there ever since. And that was its roots, really, was in trying to escape missionary work, as they saw it, but also British colonialism.
Well, they even have at this, headquarters for Deobandiism, the Department of the Rejection of Christianity. And you say to this fellow, well, what would you think if you saw that same thing, you know, in America, the Department of the Rejection of Islam? Wouldn't you find that offensive? And he said, well, you know, maybe, but they won't find anything to say against us, whereas we can say against them that Christians, again, plundered and tried to rob Muslims of their faith.
Well, yes, I mean, that's the view which, of course, many religious people hold, that they're right and everyone else is wrong. I mean, it's not just a Muslim feature of Islam.
I was thinking that when I heard him say that.
Yeah, sure. And I mean, the point is that it is an extraordinary corridor because it has not only the Department for the Rejection of Christianity, but also the Department for the Rejection of Judaism, the Department for the Rejection of Barelvism, which is an alternative sort of Sunni sect in Pakistan, the Department for the Rejection of Shiism, and so on. So it is highly intolerant. The point is that in Pakistan, it finds violent expression through all these organizations. In India, it doesn't.
Well, that's the question that you ask. What's the difference between intolerance and violence? And that takes us to Pakistan. You visited a madrasa there. What is the difference?
If you go to these madrasas in Pakistan, like the one I went to, it's probably the main Deobandi madrasa anyway, the best known, on the road from Islamabad to Peshawar. You know, this is a place that gave an honorary degree to Mullah Omar, the leader of the Afghan Taliban. And I was there about 10 years ago, and all these cars turned up with strange number plates I couldn't recognize. They all said, oh, yeah, well, they're the Taliban cabinet, basically, have come for the day to do some refresher courses. You know, it is an extraordinary institution run by this very well-known man in Pakistan, Maulana Mullah Sami ul Haq.
Well, in fact, we have part of your conversation with him. Let's listen.
Tell me about the range of activity that comes under Deobandism.
Deoband caters for all the needs of Muslims. Muslims need preaching and they need education. And in the political arena, Muslims need to be part of the parliamentary process. And they also need jihad.
Would you say you've trained the students at this madrasa in particular to fight jihad, to prepare them for that jihad?
It's very necessary for every nation.
Well, what does he mean by jihad? Because we've been instructed that that means different things.
Well, yes, I'm sure if I pressed him, he'd say, self-improvement or something. But the truth is that his students were given time off to go and fight in Afghanistan. And whenever the Taliban said they needed help, they would ring his madrasa and they would get help in the form of young men who were prepared to go and fight for him. I mean, you know, he's written a book recently, Sami ul Haq, which I've read, and it includes, you know, all this stuff about Osama bin Laden being the perfect man and how al-Qaeda never existed and all this sort of stuff. Yeah. So, I mean, there's no question he is very much on the radical end of violent jihadist Islam.
So Deobandis at the seat of the faith in India, who actually started a missionary movement, the nonviolent. Deobandis in Pakistan, who feel that violence is part of the necessity of the faith, if I got that right.
Yeah, I mean, the missionaries, there are also, you know, many, many. Deobandism is huge in Pakistan, and there are many people who pursue it peacefully.
Okay.
But there is this violent edge to it. Yeah.
Right. So what do you find in Britain?
Well, it's very interesting because the Deobandis tend to be very well organized. And so even though, I mean, there aren't any surveys to tell us how many what proportion of British Pakistanis are Deobandi by origin, but I would think, I mean, probably, I don't know, 10, 15% would be Deobandi. And yet, they have 40% of British mosques.
But which Deobandi are they? Are they the Deobandi of Pakistan who believe that young people should go on jihad?
Of course, most British Deobandis are entirely peaceful and live in the UK with no problems. But the fact is that if you look at the number of terror convicts, and there are now hundreds of people who have been convicted of terrorism offences since 9/11, a significant proportion of them have links to Deobandi institutions. There's no way around that. And I've been, you know, spoken to people who were thought to be, in fact, they were double agents working for MI5, but thought to be Al-Qaeda, active Al-Qaeda members, who spoke in many Deobandi mosques in Britain. So there is definitely a problem, but of course it doesn't reflect majority opinion.
Well, and that's the tightrope that everybody has to walk. So what to do about that information? There is definitely a problem. What to do about that?
Well, I mean, I'm sure just like the American government, the British government has become much more aware of these issues. I would be very surprised if any Friday sermon goes by in any of Britain's 1,700 mosques without someone who's speaking to the government quietly, telling officials what's going on. And certainly there is a growing awareness in the UK amongst officials when they've had their attention on Salafis and Wahhabis, probably they need to be paying more attention to Deobandis as well.
And Owen Bennett-Jones, I'm just wondering, listening to your documentaries, what's been the reaction there in Britain? I'm so struck with how clear, you know, when you went to the seat of this faith in India, how clear people there were that they originated as an attempt to survive British rule and Christian conversion.
If you talk to Deobandis in the Britain today, they would just say, not at all. We've moved on from that. It's not about that. It's just about preserving our form of Islam. We think we've got the right version and everyone else should follow it.
Fascinating. The BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones will link you to his documentaries on the Deobandi branch of Islam at hereandnow.org. Owen, thanks as always.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
West Virginia is dealing with more heavy rain and the threat of flash floods today after devastating floods over the last several days that have led to at least 23 deaths, most of them in the small town of Raynell. Joining us now is the mayor of Raynell, Andy Pendleton. And Mayor, we're so sorry for what you're going through and, of course, the loss of lives. What's the situation there right now?
Our town's in a horrible shape right now. All the businesses, the water rushed through all of our businesses downtown area, and all the homes are flooded and pretty much in destructive stage. We have the National Guard on hand now. People are removing things out of their homes, and they're cleaning up the sites. It's a slow process, but it's a necessary process to do correct. And our power came back on yesterday evening, but it's not on down where the flood stage is. And the water system is barely up. We had a $2.6 million loan to help our drinking water situation. It was completed this December, and the water got in the water plant. Right now, we did get the water turned on, but it's just a little bit of water coming through, but we have some major leaks throughout the area.
Well, and I was reading some of the people in Raynell talking about what it's like there right now. I see a quote here, "The people that are left here in Raynell don't have much, and what they did have, everybody just lost."
We're hoping to rebuild. Years ago, John Rain came to our town, him and his brother Tom, during the 1933 Depression. The quotation was, because it was the world's largest lumber mill here, was his town built to carry on. We've got it as our motto anyway, but we're going to stand back. This is going to be a town built to carry on because the people of the town. And actually, people from out of state and all over are coming to help us. We've got a big tractor trailer coming in from Texas to help us. We have people coming with plaster. We need building spaces to provide for everything that's coming in.
But of course the rain keeps coming as well. So what's the danger at this point with the continuing floods?
Oh, the debris is terrible. It is absolutely just heart-wrenching. We've had a rough time with unemployment lately and the coal miners out of work, and this breaks the heart.
It's hard to even talk about. Yeah.
Yes. People are great. They're smiling. They want to know when FEMA's coming. They're anxiously waiting for FEMA. I guess they're waiting for an instant miracle, which I would too. When they came in from the flood, we have shelters, and the shelters got flooded. It is flooded where it had flooded before. They came in with wet clothes, and we didn't have any clothes for them, but we had a school buses that came, and up above us, about 30 miles from away, we sent 6 busloads out to Instead Baptist Church and Sunny Road Baptist Church and gave them showers and clothed them and gave them food. This is the people that we have around here that help out. We love our people here, and we love the surrounding area. We've got to stay strong.
Well, we hope you get all the things you need as you go through this difficult time. Mayor Pendleton, thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck to you.
God bless you all, and thank you for caring.
An irony after Britain's voted for independence from the European Union is that the UK itself, England and Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland, was considered a smaller version of the EU. And over the years, when Scotland and separately many Northern Irelanders wanted out of the UK, the English were against it. Now Scots, who in the Brexit vote voted largely to stay with the EU, want another vote to leave the UK. And there are calls in Northern Ireland for a new referendum on leaving the UK and joining the Republic of Ireland, which is, of course, independent and still a member of the EU. So is this the end of the UK? Let's start in Scotland. Tom Morton is a former BBC Radio Scotland music presenter. When we spoke with him 2 years ago, he was against Scottish independence. He joined us by Skype from the Shetland Islands. And Tom, do we understand you are now for leaving the UK?
Well, I think the shocking news from England means that really I don't think there's any alternative. If we're to maintain a social democracy in Scotland, which is liberal, outgoing, welcoming to migrants, and which believes in social justice, I don't really see any alternative, because what's happened in England is the establishment for the long term of an extreme right-wing racist government. And I don't think people in Scotland want anything to do with that.
Well, tell us more about this. When you say welcoming to migrants, maybe perhaps protecting those who are fleeing civil war, as we're seeing from Syria. But tell me more about what that means to you. Does it have to do with the economy as well?
It does have to do with the economy, but let's face it, there are terrible risks to an independent Scotland economically. The price of oil has gone through the floor. We have all kinds of issues. We just don't know what's going to happen in the future. But it seems, I think, to most people in Scotland that staying within the European Union is our right. And what's going to happen tomorrow, in fact, is that Nicola Sturgeon, the Scottish First Minister, is going to Europe to discuss the possibilities of staying within the European Union. And in fact, Michael D. Higgins from the Republic of Ireland is in Scotland today, engaged in discussions with her too.
Yeah, well, there's been a call for a new vote on Scottish independence. But it's not exactly that you feel it will negatively impact your economy. In fact, going independent might be more negative. That's interesting, because we're hearing about what's being called now regrets-it, you know, instead of Brexit, a realization in Britain that a huge portion of the membership fee that Britain paid to the EU came back, many of it in money that subsidized things like poor farmers.
If you travel throughout Scotland, you'll continually see the stars of Europe on road signs to do with projects that have been funded or part-funded by the European Union. And that's true in England as well. Places like Cornwall, which voted something like 70% to 30% to leave the European Union. Cornwall is heavily dependent on European funding. But in terms of what's happened in England especially, this kind of reaction that we've seen is really a kind of anti-politics. It's post-truth politics. Mm. It's the kind of thing that you're seeing in the USA in terms of a hugely emotional reaction, which against all the evidence may vote for Donald Trump as president. It's exactly that kind of knee-jerk anti-intellectual reaction. And what we're seeing, too, is a rejection of traditional politics in the form of the Labour Party. As I speak, the Labour Party, the traditional opposition to the Conservatives, is in total meltdown. And we are looking at a new leadership election there.
Well, and so you're saying it's more about a pervasive feeling that this reflects things like racism, xenophobia, that you say the Scots are rejecting. Do you also see the irony that we mentioned, or as Max Fisher put it in the New York Times, that having survived the nationalist yearnings from Scotland and Northern Ireland, the UK is now succumbing to the nationalism of its largest and most powerful group, the English, that there's some irony there.
Well, yeah, I think that's accurate. I think there is an element of Little England nationalism happening here. And I mean, it's understandable in some ways because we've seen the almost complete destruction in the old industrial areas like Newcastle and Sunderland, who stunningly reversed expectations and voted to leave the European Union. In those places, heavy industry has gone and disappeared. Tremendous problems with unemployment and poverty.
So you understand some of that feeling?
I totally understand it. And also, that has been blamed. But I mean, it's a terrible lesson from history which hasn't been learned. That has been blamed in immigration. And that people are saying, oh, these people are coming in from the European Union countries and taking our jobs. It's really not the case. I have to admit that Scotland is slightly isolated from the immigration situation because we are further away. We are very far north and we're cold and wet. And perhaps it's the case that there are other places within the United Kingdom that some migrants would rather stay in.
Yeah. Tom Morton, former BBC Radio Scotland music presenter on A Voice from Scotland, the Shetland Islands specifically. Tom, thank you.
Thank you.
And now to Ireland, of course, divided into the Independent Republic of Ireland, a member of the EU, and Northern Ireland as part of the UK. It must now leave the EU. The EU has open borders, but since Northern Ireland is leaving, a border will have to be set up between the two countries, reminding many Irish people of the checkpoints that used to exist during the Troubles. Seamus Coyle is a county councillor in County Monaghan in the Republic of Ireland on the border there. And Seamus, how is this impacting people?
This has huge consequences. I live within a short distance of the border. We have 500 kilometres of border here between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, which is now, and indeed when the UK exits the EU, this will be the only land border with the EU. So the changes are going to be massive.
Well, let's remind people that being in the EU, part of it meant open borders. Now, the border control checkpoints that were taken away by the Good Friday Peace Accords, there was a free flow between Northern Ireland and Ireland, one presumes would have to go up again. I mean, that's just a physical reminder of, you know, a checkpoint. But what else does that border mean to you?
So we are now in a very much a land of the unknown. Agricultural exports are absolutely enormous. We here in County Monaghan, 84% of poultry exports go to the UK. 52% of beef, 60% of dairy products go into the UK. Northern Ireland has voted very much to remain within the UK. But let's remember that many of the farmers in Northern Ireland, their disposable income incorporates approximately well in excess of 80%. That comes in direct EU supports.
So what do you think about what we're hearing out of Northern Ireland, a push to now have a referendum to vote on whether Northern Ireland should join Ireland?
Yes, indeed. And indeed, as a Republican and as a member of the Fianna Fáil party here and a nationalist, I very much idealise a united Ireland. And indeed, that is one of our founding principles, as does all Irish people and indeed all nationalists. However, I do believe that they demand from the Sinn Féin party for an immediate referendum on a border poll is indeed opportunistic, because I do believe that Prime Minister Cameron made a huge mistake in 2012 in guaranteeing the referendum. I think when you hold a referendum, while it is the democratic and it is the greatest act of democracy that a nation can hold, I believe that the timing must be right.
So are you saying that you think the Northern Ireland, perhaps a Northern Ireland vote on leaving Britain and joining Ireland, should wait until heads are cooler, or wait, you know, maybe not be held at all, because be careful what you wish for?
No, I certainly would like to see that within a period of years, and certainly to see a united Ireland within my lifetime, because self-determination is the greatest hope of all peoples. But I believe, and you use the words there, cooling of heads, we must allow that to happen. We must have a very rational debate. We must put all of the structure to underpin a united Ireland in place.
Yeah. Ireland will be just so isolated there. If you picture Great Britain as kind of a glove, and let's say you're the thumb, you know, Ireland dropping down there, you're going to be so isolated.
There is no doubting that we will certainly be in a new situation. All in all, this could be the disintegration of the UK. It could be the disintegration of Europe if we are not very careful.
That's Seamus Coyle, a county councillor in Monaghan County in the Republic of Ireland. Seamus, thank you so much.
Thank you, and indeed I wish a good day to yourself, Robin, all your listeners, and all our people. Gurumi mai lagat.
What does that mean?
That means thank you.
You too.
In Brussels today, the U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry reaffirmed the so-called special relationship between the U.S. and the U.K. after last week's Brexit vote.
Good friends are important all of the time, but they are especially important in complex times. And I want to make it clear that at this moment of challenge, the United States of America knows it could not ask for a better friend and ally than the United Kingdom.
Meanwhile, global markets continue to tumble, and the rating agency S&P today downgraded the UK's sovereign credit rating from AAA to AA. For more on what the Brexit means for you and your wallet, we're joined by Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Jeremy.
And does this look to you like a temporary blip in the markets or something bigger, something more long-term?
Well, I think it's more long-term because we are having a process laid out in front of us that could last two and a half years. And because of that uncertainty, because we don't really understand the process and how it will affect the economies of Great Britain, as well as the European Union, even ours, it's hard to say that uncertainty is going to somehow be lifted miraculously. So I think we're with a little bit of volatility here for some time and at least the foreseeable future.
Why is there such uncertainty? I mean, we know that there's uncertainty because we don't know what's going to happen next. But does it surprise you that people were so caught off guard by this? There were two possibilities. Either they leave or they stay. This was what you would think that people would have gamed this out a little bit more and been prepared.
Yeah, I was actually very surprised because I would talk to traders and hedge fund managers and private equity people who seems almost like smug, like there's no way that's ever going to happen. And, you know, you say to yourself, But the polls are pretty close. No. You'll see. It'll be just like Scottish independence 2 years
right.
ago. The polls look close, but then it really wasn't. And so I think that there was an element of that they wouldn't really possibly do such a thing. And when it happened, that's perhaps part of the outsized reaction early on, especially in the wee hours of the morning in our futures markets. But that said, let's be clear that the leaving process can go lots of different ways. There's a model whereby the UK just leaves the EU and they don't benefit from any part of that single market. They rely on the World Trade Organization, and that's the basis of trading. Now, that would be very severe. There are folks who think, well, the Norwegian model is probably more like it for the UK. That would be the UK leaving the European Union. They join something called the European Economic Area. So you get the 28 EU member states plus Norway, Iceland, and Liechtenstein. And you get some of the great benefits of the EU, the free movement of goods and services and capital. But in that model, you also get the free movement of people. And that is linked to immigration. And I'm questioning in my head, well, if you've just built an entire campaign to leave,
right,
primarily on immigration, are they going to really agree to that? And then finally, there's this model called the Swiss model. And, you know, Switzerland is sort of an entity unto itself in Europe. And in that model, you don't join any sort of economic area union. What you do is you negotiate with European industries directly. And with some industries, you've got big access, in others, not so much.
And the other thing about Switzerland is, unlike the United Kingdom, it's so heavily Swiss. I mean, it's not near as diverse as the United Kingdom. So it would surprise me if the UK can say, we're going to go with the Swiss model and try to be just like Switzerland because they are so different. But what, Jill, does it mean for people in this country and for ordinary Americans as they watch this? We spoke with Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, and here's what he said about that.
You know, the experience is that when you try to outguess the markets, you usually end up selling at the bottom and buying at the top. And so the advice I would give anyone who's not an investment professional is just stay the course.
That's what they always say, isn't it, Joe?
Yeah, and for the first time in my life, I might say I agree with Larry Summers. Now, that said, I disagree with one part, which is he said for, you know, ordinary investors. I would say that professional investors are often dumber than the rest of us. And the reason is what they do is they blow out of all their positions when they're freaked out and caught off guard, just like they're doing today and they did Friday. And they then scramble in and chase the markets higher because they don't know how to market time better than anyone else does. So, okay, absolutely. You don't want to let your emotions dictate your investment decisions. You're a long-term investor. You don't have all your eggs in one basket. I get that. On the other hand, I want to be clear. If you need money for something and you, whoops, by mistake, had that money at risk, you got to get out of that position. So if you had your kid's college tuition money that's due in a couple of months in an S&P 500 fund, you've got to sell it. You've got to get out, free up that money, and make sure it's protected. For everyone else, be happy. You're buying shares on sale. That's a good thing. You kind of embrace this volatility. And look, don't look at your stock positions. Look at your bond positions. They're doing beautifully.
And it seems like every time you see a big, bad day in the stock market, that's where Warren Buffett makes all of his money. Buy
yeah,
low,
exactly.
Sell high.
Yeah, and I want to say one last thing. I know a lot of people are saying there is no financial crisis ahead. I feel very strongly that this could lead to some very scary unintended consequences. I don't think it will, but I don't think we should be as sanguine as we were going into the vote and not at least consider those possibilities.
Well, on that note, Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News, thank you.
Take care.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.